Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for December 28th, 2025, it is the Lives They Lived edition of the New York Times Magazine, remembering some of the artists, innovators, and thinkers we lost in the past year. Jane Goodall, born in 1934. She approached chimps as she did people, on their own terms. This article was written by Sam Anderson. In the beginning, Jane Goodall named the chimpanzees. This was controversial. It was 1960, back when scientists weren't supposed to dignify the animals they studied with names. They were supposed to use numbers to remain objective, to avoid anthropomorphism at all costs. This is still largely the case. But Goodall wasn't that kind of scientist. Technically, she wasn't a scientist at all. She was 26, and her only degree was a certificate from secretarial school. In fact, it was partly this inexperience that inspired Goodall's employer, the paleoanthropologist Louis Leakey, to send her off to study the wild chimps of Tanzania. Fresh eyes and a novel approach might finally penetrate the mysterious world of humanity's closest non-human relatives. This turned out to be true. Day after day, from dawn to dusk, Goodall stalked the forests, often barefoot, trying to establish rapport with the chimps. She waited, quietly filling notebooks, hoping that the creatures would come to accept this strange white ape. For months, they mostly avoided her. Finally, mutual curiosity won out. The chimps came closer and closer, eventually all the way into Goodall's camp. She fed them bananas, groomed them and was groomed in return, celebrated their births, cried over their deaths. And as she got to know them, she gave them names. David Greybeard, Mr. McGregor, Lord Dracula, Flo, Melissa. As the decades passed, as Goodall established herself as the world's leading chimpanzee expert, the roster of names grew. Beethoven, Freud, Groucho, Midge, and on and on. It occurred to me reading the remembrances of her life that Jane Goodall itself sounds like a made-up name. It's like John Nice Guy, the name of a saint or of a certain cartoon character fighting to save the world. It sounds like a name a chimpanzee might make up to describe the first human who really took them seriously. But it actually was her name, or at least part of it. She was born Valerie Jane Morris Goodall to a middle-class family in England. As a child, she was outdoorsy, adventurous, and obsessed with animals. She once coaxed a bird to nest in her bookshelves. Her mother encouraged these enthusiasms. Her father was mostly absent. At night, Goodall often dreamed that she was a man, doing things that only men were allowed to do, which often meant traveling to Africa, like the heroes in her favorite storybooks. As soon as she could, after saving up money from waitressing and secretary jobs, Goodall got herself there. And once she made contact with the chimpanzees, her path was set. For the rest of her life, 65 years, she documented and advocated on behalf of the chimps. In middle age, when Goodall could no longer live in the bush, she traveled the world relentlessly, some 300 days a year, as an educator and environmental activist. When she died at age 91, she was in the middle of a speaking tour. Just as Jane Goodall was her real name, but not quite all of it, Jane Goodall was a real person, but also an invention. A media sensation created largely by the National Geographic Society, which funded her research. One curiosity of Goodall's career is that her earth-shaking scientific discoveries, that chimpanzees eat meat and make and use tools all came from her first stint in Tanzania before the cameras arrived. The wider world still had no idea what good all looked like, and she would have been happy to keep it that way. But National Geographic sensed a visual gold mine, this photogenic blonde woman in khaki shorts, face to face with Africa's primordial great apes. They insisted on sending a photographer along with a checklist of poses. Jane looking through binoculars, Jane laughing, Jane cooking, Jane washing her hair in a stream. Goodall resented this, but she agreed to play along. She understood that in the same way that a chimp could use a blade of grass to fish termites out of a nest, she could use fame to advance her larger project, studying and protecting the chimps. "Certainly I understand that it is necessary to build up a story around Jane Goodall," she conceded in an early letter. The resulting books and articles and photos and films made her an international celebrity. A 1965 documentary, Miss Goodall and the Wild Chimpanzees, drew an estimated 25 million viewers on CBS. The photographer and videographer, the Dutchman Hugo van Lawick, would become Goodall's first husband and the father of her only child, a son who grew up partly in the bush, playing inside a cage so the chimpanzees wouldn't hurt him. Goodall eventually got a PhD from Cambridge, another tool, one that would make the scientific community take her more seriously. But she continued to bring her whole self to the work. As a performer, Goodall was sly and charismatic. She delighted human crowds by demonstrating her mastery of chimp language, an elaborate dialect of pant hoots, food grunts, wah barks, and SOS screams. I love this clip of her insulting John Oliver, chimp style, before eating a banana sideways. In Goodall's books, chimpanzee society is as convoluted as anything in Jane Austen. There is infinite drama, jealousy, alliances, schisms, betrayals. Goodall's chimps tickle each other, get colds, feast on delicacies, termites, army ants, and tease baboons by shaking wet branches over their heads. They appear to dance in the rain, mourn their dead, and sometimes die of grief. She presents them as distinct, reasoning, worthy individuals. David Greybeard had the most beautiful eyes of them all, large and lustrous, set wide apart, she writes in her book, Through a Window. They somehow expressed his whole personality, his serene self-assurance, his inherent dignity, and from time to time, his utter determination to get his way. But chimps can also be shockingly violent. Once, Goodall wrote, a male named Frodo stomped on her head so hard that it almost broke her neck. She describes males competing in apparent dominance displays, scowling, hair bristling, sprinting around and dragging branches on the ground. She documents chimps killing baby monkeys with a bite to the skull. She once chronicled a coordinated campaign of intra-chimp extermination that resembled organized human warfare. Still, Goodall never lost her admiration and devotion. She and the chimpanzees were a perfect match. They were both in-between figures. Goodall was a human living among non-humans, a media-savvy scientist, a woman in a misogynistic world. Comely Miss spends her time eyeing apes, an early headline read. And chimpanzees, as Goodall put it, blurred the line between humans and animals. Most of our genetic code is nearly 99% identical to chimps. They are more closely related to us than they are to gorillas. Chimps can sort objects, learn sign language, and recognize their own reflection. To a species as narcissistic as humans, this presents a serious identity crisis. Chimpanzees, are a funhouse mirror, both us and not us, familiar yet alien, fascinating but terrifying. One of Goodall's greatest virtues was that she refused to approach this relationship from a position of superiority or fear. She engaged the chimpanzees as much as humanly possible on their own terms. "For a long time, I never liked to look a chimpanzee straight in the eye," she wrote. "I assumed that, as is the case with most primates, this would be interpreted as a threat, or at least as a breach of good manners. Not so. As long as one looks with gentleness, without arrogance, a chimpanzee will understand, and may even return the look." George Foreman, born 1949. Before he became a lovable pitch man, he was just plain mean. This article was written by Devin Gordon. Before the hamburger grills and the ABC sitcom George that lasted 9 episodes and the boisterous appearances on Late Night with David Letterman and the monthly 30-second sermons for Esquire magazine, before it became impossible to picture him without that big teddy bear smile, George Foreman was, in his own words, the kind of man it was easy to root against. To use more of his own words, he concocted reasons for cold-cocking someone, and he couldn't stop, because it was the one thing I did well. According to the legend of the boxing match billed as the Rumble in the Jungle, Foreman's epic heavyweight title defense against Muhammad Ali in Kinshasa, Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, which began at about 4 a.m. local time on October 30, 1974, so that it could air in prime time back in America, Foreman is the villain of the story. He is terse, glowering, a pitiless 25-year-old punching machine with Samson's arms and nucleology in its fists, as Norman Mailer put it. The two fighters would split a record-setting $10.45 million purse, but Mailer, who would later write a book about the fight, feared that the aging Ali, then 32, wouldn't survive to collect any of that money. But 9 days before the bout, Foreman was hit above his right eye during a sparring session, opening up a cut that forced the fight to be delayed 6 weeks. He was never able to get comfortable in Zaire. He hated the food, the bugs, the stairs wherever he went, and he rarely left his hotel except to train. Ali jogged through villages with local kids and charmed the continent. On the night of the fight, he entered the ring in the Stade Tata Raphael to a chorus of 60,000 spectators chanting, "Ali, Bomaye, Ali, Bomaye, Ali, kill him." Back home, in the parts of Black America where the two fighters were raised, Foreman in Houston, Ali in Louisville, Ali was a civil rights hero who had forfeited his heavyweight title over his refusal to serve in Vietnam and then fought his criminal conviction all the way to the Supreme Court. Foreman had won a gold medal in boxing for the United States at the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City, but even some of his kin were mortified by his celebration, prancing around the ring with a tiny American flag at the same games where John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised their fists. Foreman's gradual transfiguration from global villain to beloved pitchman is one of the great reverse heel turns in all of sports, and it began that morning in Kinshasa. In the fourth round, Foreman wobbled Ali and moved in for the kill, only to hesitate because he spotted one of his closest friends in the crowd, a man I'd considered family, booing and rooting against him. That sight is, in fact, the image I recall most vividly from the fight, Foreman later wrote in his 1995 memoir, By George. "In a state of shock, I couldn't deliver the punch that probably would have ended the fight." 4 rounds later, Ali ended it instead. Foreman had thrown so many punches he could barely lift his arms. He had exhausted all his nuclearology. It was his first defeat in 41 fights. Losing his title humiliated him. He fled from city to city, Paris for a week, then Los Angeles, then Houston, then back to Los Angeles, holing up in hotels, sleeping with different women nightly, embarrassed to show his face in public. Eventually, he retreated to his ranch, a few hours north of Houston, with little but his German shepherds and pet lion to keep him company. He grew consumed with regaining the title, even putting up a photo on his wall of Ali knocking him to the mat in Zaire. "After I'd lost to Ali," he wrote, "I decided I needed more hate. I'd hit you in the kidneys or on the back of the head." 6 months later, Foreman began his comeback by knocking out 5 men in one night at an exhibition described in Sports Illustrated as bordering on vaudeville. He pulverized an aging Joe Frazier and loomed over him on the mat, drinking in the booze from the crowd. "He needs a shrink and a trainer in that order," Howard Cosell later declared. By March 1977, Foreman and Ali had agreed in principle to a rematch. The purse would be $13 million. Foreman already had a fight scheduled in San Juan, Puerto Rico, against another title contender. All he had to do was win and he would get his shot at revenge. But he was fixated on proving he had the stamina to go the distance in a fight, and once again, he pulled the decisive punch, got knocked down in the 12th round, and wound up losing in a unanimous decision. The rematch was gone. In his training room after the fight, Foreman was so consumed by despair and self-loathing that his body crumbled. He felt himself sink into a deep void. The bottom of the bottom of the bottom, and on the very brink of death, according to his account, he saw Jesus and was born again. "The boiling rage he had always felt was no longer in my computer programming," he wrote. "This was nothing like being hungry and forcing yourself not to eat. The anger just wasn't there." Foreman was 28, and he was done with boxing. "To knock a guy out, I needed to psych myself into a state of viciousness," he went on. But that George Foreman didn't exist anymore. Within months, he was standing on a street corner in tiny Marshall, Texas, with a portable amplifier and a microphone, preaching the word of God. Then he drove to Shreveport, Louisiana, and did the same thing. He had shaved his head and mutton chops and mustache, and he was smiling ear to ear, not scowling, so it took people a minute to recognize him as the former heavyweight champion of the world. In town after town, he would get out of his car somewhere and start preaching, and people would gather and slowly realize to their astonishment who it was. Word spread, of course. He got invitations to appear on the 700 Club and the PTL Club with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. He baptized hardened criminals in a small tub at San Quentin. Soon he opened up his own church, the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ. Nothing special, just an old building that he and his congregants fixed up with the $25,000 he got from selling a tractor. "It's not Madison Square Garden, but I like it," he told Sports Illustrated. His sermons were funny, and the butt of his jokes was always George Foreman, his waistline, his hairline, his failures at marriage. 4 divorces before the 5th union stuck, and fatherhood, 12 children in all, including 5 boys named George and a girl named Georgetta. This was another explicit instruction from God. Shed the fearsome persona and become a pure entertainer. His job, he wrote, was to keep them laughing, never get serious, always have a joke, turn all dark questions into something funny. At one point after his rebirth, Foreman was invited to join an evangelical mission to Africa, and in Kinshasa, just steps from the spot where Ali had knocked him out in 1974, he delivered a sermon in front of 60,000 people. This time, he wrote, they cheered. Anna Ornstein, born 1927. Deported to Auschwitz as a teen, she pushed psychoanalysis to think about Holocaust survivors in a new way. This article was written by Daniel Bergner. Dr. Anna Ornstein survived Auschwitz-Birkenau at age 17. There, her father and grandmother were killed in the gas chambers. Her two brothers were pressed into labor for the Axis armies and never returned. Later, as a psychoanalyst, she published academic writing that sometimes took a personal turn and held a muted yet unmistakable rage. That anger was not focused on Hitler or the memory of especially cruel SS guards. It was aimed at a prevalent psychoanalytic perspective that she felt failed to see, let alone learn from, the experience of Holocaust survivors. Ornstein grew up in a Hungarian farming town, where for the tiny Jewish minority, anti-Semitism was severe but not insurmountable. Then came German occupation and the packed cattle cars that hauled Jews toward almost inevitable extermination. At Auschwitz-Birkenau, living on a once-daily chunk of bread and some kind of cooked grass, as Ornstein would recall in a short memoir, she and her mother fended for each other. Ornstein became my mother's eyes after her mother's glasses were confiscated. She masked her mother's weakness so she wouldn't be marked for death. Her mother, for her part, persuaded Ornstein that it was only rumor when prisoners spoke of the distinctive smell in the air as coming from burning bodies. After stints in two more Nazi camps and finally liberation, mother and daughter made their way back to Hungary, where Ornstein's mother took charge of an orphanage for 40 Jewish children who lost their families. She insisted that every child be bathed in attention by any available adult, that the cook, the gardener, the maid, whoever else was around, Ornstein wrote, should stay at the bedside of any child who struggled to fall asleep. The healing of the children was essential to her mother's own. Ornstein herself found healing in her marriage to a young man, Paul Ornstein, whom she had adored since meeting him when she was 14 and he 17. Paul had escaped from forced labor with the German army and later Soviet army detention. The children from the orphanage gathered in a choir to sing at the wedding. If the orphanage and the wedding sound like sentimental set pieces in a Holocaust movie, they would also become crucial to Ornstein's vision as a clinician and an academic. Ornstein followed Paul to medical school and, after they immigrated to the United States, into psychoanalytic training in the 1960s. But Ornstein felt that classical psychoanalysis failed to reckon with the individual and complex experiences of what she and other Holocaust survivors endured, and how, in a great many cases, they overcame what they went through. Analysts in training undergo their own analyses. One day, Ornstein took a written account of her experiences to her analyst, who was also the chairman of the psychiatry department at the University of Cincinnati, where she had studied. Two of Ornstein's grown children, Raphael and Sharon Ornstein, both psychoanalysts themselves, told me about the incident. They didn't know exactly what their mother had written, but they guessed that she made an urgent effort to have her specific story and her capacity to recover understood. The next day, the chairman's secretary handed the pages back, saying only, "This is yours." Ornstein reiterated that the document was meant for her analyst. The secretary replied, "He said, 'This is yours.'" From his responses, Ornstein recounted in a 2014 essay, "I learned early on that it was preferable for me not to share my Holocaust experiences with him." Psychoanalysis was built on Freud's ideas about the unconscious sexual drives of childhood and the guilt, fear, repression, and other drives that follow from early erotic yearnings. In classic psychoanalytic treatment, a patient's troubles were seen as almost purely internal. Breakthroughs depended on unburying conflicts and torment. The Holocaust, so immensely and devastatingly external, didn't fit readily with this paradigm. It posed a tremendous challenge for mainstream psychoanalytic theory. If the field didn't always look away from the Holocaust, as Ornstein's analyst seems to have done, it often did something that was, in Ornstein's mind, worse. It reduced survivors to extreme victimhood, presuming that they could be summarily categorized as broken beings. But Ornstein and her husband found an emerging alternative. In the late 60s and early 70s, a psychoanalyst named Heinz Kohut was beginning to focus on the fundamental need for human connection, the role of the other in the experience of the self. "We take this as a given now," Sharon told me. "But back in the day, the whole idea was the isolated mind with drives and instincts." Ornstein and her husband became part of a small circle who helped Kohut develop his insights. They emphasized the necessity of human bonds. This spoke to Ornstein's experiences. She saw herself not as broken, but as resilient because of the bond with her mother, because of bonds with other concentration camp prisoners, because of fortifying familial bonds built into her life before the Holocaust, because of the bond between her and Paul. She recognized similar strength and foundations in many survivors. In her 2014 essay, she lamented in tones of open anger that psychiatrists and psychoanalysts had missed a unique opportunity to research a most remarkable phenomenon in modern history. They failed to ask, what made psychological survival in concentration camps possible? Instead, the professionals restricted their inquiry to the study of the pathological consequences of this unparalleled historical event, and then proceeded to theorize about the transgenerational transmission only. The italics are hers, of the traumatic aspects of the survivor's experiences. Her field had reduced and failed to examine not only her experiences, but also the experiences of her children. All three of Ornstein's children, Miriam, a child psychiatrist, as well as Raphael and Sharon, brought up in separate conversations how much their mother loved to dance. At weddings and bar and bat mitzvahs, she threw herself into the hora, the traditional Jewish dance usually done in a circle of held hands, with wild communal hopping and kicking. Her dancing was, in her children's words, fueled by pleasure at being with people and filled with a sense of triumph. Raphael spoke, too, of the defiance that accompanied his mother's capacity for joy. It was, "Screw you, look at me, look at my kids," he said. She was militant about resilience. I would now like to take just a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Diane Keaton, born 1946. She worried that she was inadequate at love until she became a mother. This article was written by Sasha Weiss. When Diane Keaton was nearly 50 years old, she found herself on a bumpy flight home from Cannes, terrified. She hated flying, and turbulence set her into a panic. The film she was promoting had been a modest critical success, a relief after many years of middling reviews. But as she surveyed her life, she felt lonely. She missed her grouchy dog. How could it be this was the only creature she longed for? And where was the loving partner who could hold her hand in this moment of fear? When she finally got home, she steadied herself by writing in her journal, a long habit she had learned from her mother, who meticulously documented her thoughts for 40 years. Keaton wondered how she had ended up here and whether she needed to take more risks in her life, especially those revolving around intimacy, she wrote in her memoir, Then Again. I know I have to make a decision that will or will not lead to the experience of a different kind of love, a love of less expectations on the receiving end, she wrote, speaking of her own disappointments. It was then that she decided to adopt a baby. Becoming a mother at age 50 to her daughter, Dexter, and again at 55, when she adopted her son, Duke, quelled her unease. Motherhood seemed to come easily to her. She was embracing, fun, totally engaged. She saved nearly everything her children created, drawings, cards, scraps of projects, and also the letters she wrote to them every so often, several of which she included in Then Again, attempts to cross the barriers of our 50-year age gap, sort of explanations and apologies pertaining to who I am. She was aware of the unconventionality of her choice to start a family as a single older woman and was open with her kids about the emotional challenges that adoption might involve. Being adopted is to start life with loss, she wrote in a letter to Duke. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Loss helps us learn how to handle goodbyes. Starting out knowing something others will have to learn, she went on, has its advantages. You will already have the tools to make you more open to the many varieties of love. This introspection and emotional transparency were typical of Keaton. They were the wellspring of her acting as well as her mothering. Keaton always credited her first New York acting teacher, Sandy Meisner, with her unpretentious, lucid style. When she arrived in the city at 19, the beloved eldest daughter in a family of four siblings who were raised in California, she desperately wanted to succeed, but she worried she wasn't beautiful enough. She hadn't yet taken possession of her expressive face or her offhand elegance. She soon fell in with a group of eccentric artists and met Woody Allen, whom she dated for a few years. He cast her in her breakout role at age 31 as Annie Hall. The character is based on Keaton and her indelible wardrobe. Trench coats, fetching ties, and bowler hats was pulled from Keaton's own closet. Annie revealed to the world Keaton's essence, a conspiring warmth overlaid with a jangling, neurotic charm. In short order, Keaton became a major star, playing a variety of complex roles. Teresa Dunn in Looking for Mr. Goodbar and Louise Bryant in Reds, and having love affairs with Warren Beatty and Al Pacino. She admired these men all her life, writing sharp portraits of them in her memoirs, but she seemed to blame herself for failing to settle into a long-term partnership. This is a leitmotif in Keaton's writing, a sense that she was inept at intimacy and needed to fix herself, until the moment she became a mother. Despite her huge early success, there was a stretch of years in the late 80s and early 90s when many of the films she was in did poorly. She described to a friend having to essentially beg for roles, but her insecurities lived alongside a sturdy trust in her own artistic impulses. She was a collector of California Monterey furniture, Bauer pottery, houses that she would exquisitely renovate and sell. She edited books of photographs, California Spanish architecture, tabloid photos, and old Hollywood promotional images, to name a few, and kept reams of journals, spending decades in psychoanalysis laying herself bare. When her mother got sick with Alzheimer's disease, Keaton documented her decline, even lovingly transcribing confused voicemail messages. After her mother died, Keaton wrote, Then Again, the richest of her three memoirs, in which she laid her mother's account of her life in her journals, anguished, determined, beautifully composed, with her own. It's a relentlessly self-inspecting double portrait in which Keaton reckons with having lived the varied, freewheeling life her mother never got to. As her mother's mind was fading, Keaton was immersed in the clamor of motherhood, driving Dexter to swim practice, roughhousing with Duke. Her deepest desire, she wrote, was to give her children what her mother had given her, the freedom to become themselves. "I believe people evolve into who they want to be," she wrote to Dexter in a letter. "In a way, you create who you are." Amid all the change in her life, Keaton's career revived. She had transformed herself from the elusive, uncertain woman of her early films into a stately one whose comedy was bolstered by worldliness. In Father of the Bride, The First Wives Club, and her favorite film, Something's Gotta Give, she plays women of a certain age, firmly planted in their lives with wisdom and mirth to spare. But she never lost that quiver of sensitivity, her ready access to emotional truth. In Something's Gotta Give, Keaton plays Erica Berry, a lauded playwright who has forsworn romance. Jack Nicholson is Harry Sanborn, a notorious cad who dates only women under 30. Unexpectedly thrown together in a summer house, they find themselves submitting to a surprising passion. After they first have sex, Harry clams up, getting up from bed and declaring that he prefers to sleep alone. "I'm an old dog," he tells her. In response, Keaton delivers a performance that, in the span of 90 seconds, lets us in on a whole history of emotional defense and disarmament. Her face, more radiant than ever, opens and closes like a fan, revealing all the nakedness and yearning that new love can still summon, and then the desolation it can bring, the gathering of courage it requires. Moved by her, Harry eventually comes back to bed. This capacity to ask for and receive love may be this accomplished woman's biggest accomplishment. Erica's self-possession is Keaton's. She was a woman whose unyielding singularity, her urge to really know herself, gave her access to her deepest feelings and eventually to the boundless, giving self she had always wanted to be. Clint Hill, born 1932. The Secret Service agent was haunted by JFK's death and his failure to prevent it. This article was written by Matt Flagenheimer. For nearly all his life, Clint Hill discussed the events of November 22, 1963, the situation in Dallas, he called it, exactly twice. In 1964 with the Warren Commission, and in 1975 with Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. He did not talk about that day with friends or medical professionals or his wife at the time. He did not talk about it with fellow Secret Service agents to whom he had flashed a desperate thumbs down from the president's car. He did not talk about it with Jacqueline Kennedy, whose life he probably saved in Dallas, or with Robert F. Kennedy, whom Hill had informed by phone from Parkland Memorial Hospital. "It's as bad as it can get." The attorney general hung up. By then, Hill's Friday afternoon chronicled in due course across feature film, amateur film, good television, bad television, oral history, federal inquiry, pre-internet fever swamp, internet fever swamp, podcast era fever swamp, was already doomed to shadow his next 6 decades. Hill, then 31, had been assigned to protect the First Lady. He was riding through Dealey Plaza on the running board of the follow-up car when he heard an explosive noise from his right. He saw President John F. Kennedy grabbing at his throat and sagging to the left. Sprinting from his vehicle to the Kennedys, Hill grasped a trunk handle and yanked himself aboard. The man in the business suit, almost superheroic in the Zapruder footage, racing into history, but too late to reverse it. Mrs. Kennedy in her pink suit and pillbox hat had climbed onto the limousine's rear reflexively, collecting the material, Hill said later, that had escaped the president's head. Hill pushed her back into her seat. If he hadn't, according to commission testimony, she most likely would have fallen to the roadway in the motorcade's path. Hill threw his body over the president and first lady, gripping the door frame to elevate himself into the line of anything else coming. He could see a hole in the president's skull. Roughly 6 seconds had passed between the first shot and the fatal third shot, Hill noted afterward. He would forever believe he might have been able to save Kennedy with half a second more. It was my fault, he told Wallace 12 years later, sitting next to his wife and fighting tears while clawing at a cigarette. No one has ever suggested that for an instant, Wallace said accurately. If I had reacted just a little bit quicker, and I could have, I guess, Hill insisted, and I'll live with that to my grave. He looked like a man who would keep his word. Until his death last February at 93, Hill was consigned to a life spent revisiting the best view of the worst thing, the best chance to have no real chance to save the president. He had attempted suicide 37 days after Dallas, he shared in 2022, walking fully clothed into the ocean off Palm Beach, Florida, where he was accompanying Mrs. Kennedy and her children. A police officer rescued him. Instead, Hill lived long enough to shudder through future executive assassination attempts, from Gerald Ford to Donald Trump, a reel of fresh and harrowing Kennedy family tragedies, an entwined escalation of political hostilities and tinfoil-hatted plots to rationalize them, for which November 22nd remains an American urtext, a procession of lone gunmen mass shooters who reminded Hill of Lee Harvey Oswald. He winced at every grassy knoll yarn about phantom accomplices and magic bullets, affirming the non-magic of the mainstream Dallas account not because he was an apologist or a lackey, but because no one has ever remembered and re-examined more about 6 seconds of their workday in the history of employment. Hill left the Secret Service in 1975, but had never wanted to retire from the greatest job he'd known, the one that had turned a former North Dakota orphan into codename Dazzle, delivering him to Brazil with Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Australia with Lyndon B. Johnson, and Greece with Mrs. Kennedy, where her husband had instructed Hill not to let her near Aristotle Onassis. No, Hill was retired by medical dictate after failing a physical with what nobody yet called severe PTSD. He spent much of the next decade self-medicating in his basement. He developed a habit of walking around Washington with his head down, lest anyone recognize him as the agent who couldn't quite get there. In 1990, Hill decided to visit Oswald's sixth-floor perch at the Texas School Book Depository building. He signed in under a pseudonym. He interrogated every angle. He concluded that he'd never had a true chance after all, though he would revert to sporadic self-flagellation in perpetuity. In his later years, at the urging of Lisa McCubbin Hill, an author who became his second wife, Hill started talking and writing about Dallas, what he saw, what he did, what it did to him, in books, on television, and at public events. It was cathartic, he found. He could talk about other things, too, his efforts to bring women into the Secret Service, his frustration with Mary Kennedy, conspiracists like Oliver Stone and Donald Trump, who in 2016 pushed a lie tying Ted Cruz's father to Oswald. By 2017, when the government released a long-awaited trove of Kennedy documents, Hill was comfortable enough to make the Capitol rounds again, and identifiable enough to be ambushed by TMZ outside his hotel. People always have these different conspiracy theories, the cameraman reminded him in an Olympic feat of Kennedy splaining. Didn't he ever wonder? Never, Hill said. I was there. Roberta Flack, born 1937. She dreamed of being a classical pianist, but made pop history instead. This article was written by Rob Horberger. The piano, she remembered, didn't smell very good. Her father had rescued it from a junkyard, and a distinct odor lingered, left by what she imagined to be little rat tiny people that once lived inside. Still, it was the piano her family could afford, and she took to it immediately. The beauty of a Chopin prelude or a Mozart sonata, overcoming the smell and any other rigors of regular practice. By the time Roberta Flack was in high school in Arlington, Virginia, she had grown so proficient that she was voted most musical, and classmates predicted she would make it to Carnegie Hall. I was very popular, she said, because I could play anything. She graduated at 15 and won a scholarship to Howard University, where she dreamed of becoming a professional classical pianist. Not the easiest pursuit, especially given the headwinds of racism and sexism. But the music community at Howard was rich. The future R&B great Donny Hathaway would meet her there later, among others, and at least one black woman, the opera singer Leontine Price, had risen to the top of the classical field in the 1950s. Why couldn't Flack with her talent be next? But those headwinds proved too strong, and she realized that the prospects for a classical career weren't very promising. The idea in my mind was always to do something musical. It was not necessarily if I can't be a concert pianist, I'm going to quit, she told NPR in 1989. I mean, after you practice all those years and all those hours, you must find a light of some kind. She got a degree in music education, sometimes teaching Bach chorals to kids who ran in from tobacco fields to rehearse with her. The concert artiste, alter ego, she imagined, Rubina Flake, was never far away, waiting for her chance to emerge. It would take almost a decade, but she figured out a strategy, applying classical leanings to other types of music. There were club dates, and in 1969, an album, First Take, the blueprint for an entire career. It had a compelling mixology of classical jazz, gospel, folk, and blues, as well as lyrics about civil rights, gay men, who were among her early supporters, justice, all presented in a plain-spoken, slow, unspooling style. The jazz musician Les McCann, who helped discover Flack, wrote in the album's liner notes that she carried the listener beyond every barrier as though it never existed. The larger public wasn't quite ready for her. The top 40 was still mostly the province of car radio caffeine and not Flack's brand of slow-drip testimonies. But one listener with more patient ears was Clint Eastwood, who 2 years later put Flack's version of The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face in the movie Play Misty for Me. An old folk song turned into a 5-minute-plus meditation on erotic bliss. It played in its entirety with no dialogue. Something clicked. It became a huge hit, but it was only a warm-up for her magnum opus, Killing Me Softly with His Song. Another long piece of musical mesmerism. Even if you didn't recognize the classical touches, these records made you feel smarter. And of course, there were her trademark deep steeps of emotion. Fans would come up to her and say, "Yeah, that's my life," she recalled in a radio interview. Now the 36-year-old former schoolteacher was the premier female vocalist in pop music, in an era that included Diana Ross and Aretha Franklin. There were Grammys and an apartment in the Dakota where she lived next door to John Lennon and Yoko Ono. With the jazzy, spritzy, Feel Like Makin' Love in 1974, she became the first solo female artist of the rock era to land number one pop hits in 3 consecutive years. All of a sudden, you get that rush of 20,000, 30,000, 50,000 people. The world, she told Time in 1975. All these people love me, you think. Then you're back in a hotel room by yourself in Missouri. Your stomach hurts, and your humanness just overwhelms you. As her stature grew, the headwinds picked up again. Some critics started to suggest that her sound was a little too easy on the ears, maybe a little too white. One of the hassles of being a black female musician, she said in 1975, is that people are always backing you into a corner and telling you to sing soul. I'm a serious artist. I feel a kinship with people like Arthur Rubinstein and Glenn Gould. If I can't play Bartok when I want to play Bartok, then nothing else matters. She added, it doesn't make me very popular in certain communities. She continued to defy trends and critics. In 1978, at the height of disco fever, she released a luxuriant ballad, The Closer I Get to You, a duet with Hathaway. It sold 1 million copies. A few years later, she put out maybe her most placid single, Making Love, the theme song from one of the first mainstream movies about a gay romance. The lyrics were general, but this was the 1980s, when just being associated with the movie posed a risk. I could never be afraid to sing a song about love, whether between a man and a woman, two men or two women, she said. The song made the top 20. Flack was still giving concerts in her 80s until ALS forced her to stop singing in 2022. She did make it to Carnegie Hall, 16 times, in fact. While she may never have played a program of her beloved Chopin or Bartok there, she did perform works by other master composers, the likes of Stevie Wonder, Carole King, Lennon and McCartney, and with pieces like Killing Me Softly and Feel Like Makin' Love, there was no shortage of classics for her to play her own. Douglas Follett, born 1926. The park ranger witnessed America's glaciers melting in real time. This article was written by Nathaniel Rich. Douglas Follett believed that when you visited Sperry Glacier, you left your spirit behind. That made him the Hermes of Glacier National Park in Montana, for it was his job to guide souls to the glacier. Over his 6-decade tenure as a park ranger, however, the 9-hour hike from Lake McDonald lengthened, not because Follett grew older and somewhat less spry. No, the glacier moved. For decades, its edge had kissed the top step of a narrow staircase carved into a cliff that marked the trail's terminus. But in the late 1990s, upon emerging from the stair one spring, Follett saw red, 6 inches of exposed red argillite. That'll be covered up next year, he told himself. The following year, he encountered 6 feet of red rock. This has to stop, he commanded the glacier. But the third spring, the red patch extended 16 feet, then 60, then 600. Today you have to hike another 0.5 mile from the stair before you can even see the tip of the glacier glinting in a distant hollow of Gunsight Mountain. In 1961, when Follett was 35, became a ranger, there were at least 37 glaciers in the park. All have shrunk since then, with a dozen relegated by the United States Geological Survey to anonymity. Follett was among the last rangers to witness the mighty Two Ocean Glacier, as well as Gem, Hudson, and Baby, and among the first to connect the phenomenon to global warming. The world, or at least a substantial percentage of the 3 million people who annually visit Glacier, knew him as Ranger Doug. But Follett didn't call himself a ranger. He preferred interpreter, a Park Service appellation that in Follett found its fullest expression. In boat tours, campfire talks, and impromptu exchanges at the visitor center, where he became the main attraction, Follett interpreted the meaning of glacier to generations of disciples. The mountains were a fount of wonder, sanctuary, even democracy. Short-tailed weasels were friends. Waterfalls carrying away a glacier's lifeblood ventured forth to seek their destiny in the sea. A cottonwood tree didn't die but decided to lay down. While Follett spoke, he also drew out his listeners, hoping to awaken an intimacy with the splendor all around. The story Follett told about his own life began when he was 1 year old and his father, a railroad man for the Great Northern, was assigned to East Glacier Park. While his father worked the depot, Follett and his mother roamed the Grand Lodge, where the terraces were draped with bear pelts and visitors were greeted by hired Blackfoot Indians in feathered headdresses. In high school, he met Anastasia, his wife of more than 7 decades, by offering her a stick of gum. After serving in the Air Force at the end of World War II, he never boarded another airplane. Instead, he liked to say, the world came to him. During the school year, he taught American history in Columbia Falls, another act of exuberant interpretation. At home, the stories continued with his 4 daughters each night before bed and on road trips in their 1948 Chevy. The unifying theme, said his daughter Karen, was that the world was all tied together. Unable to abide the conventions of town life, Follett bought 7 acres of cedar forest on Whitefish Lake, within earshot of the Great Northern. He did not get around to installing plumbing until the year after they moved in. The Folletts hauled 5 pail buckets from the lake. The house was warmed by a fireplace Follett assembled from slabs of green argillite. When his daughter Jen missed 3 days of high school one particularly freezing winter, a teacher asked after her absence. I had to keep the home fires burning, she said. She wasn't joking. The summers at Glacier, where the family lived in a rustic cabin, felt like a vacation. In the 80s, ponderosa pine saplings began to colonize their backyard, an ominous indicator of warmer, drier weather. Then Follett noticed the red rock devouring Sperry. The stories he told about Glacier began to change. Some park visitors question the scale of climate change, said Michael Faist, a former colleague about 70 years Follett's junior. Faist summoned data, charts. But Doug could say, I walked to the edge when I was 40. That affected people differently. That is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.